Study after study paint the picture. The generation born between 1981 and 1996, the millennials, they are on track to be the first generation not to exceed their parents in terms of income or job status. We're pulling back the layers on what this means on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Millennials, especially millennials of color, have lower homeownership rates than previous generations. Are you in this generation and unable to make a living to be middle class or to buy a home or a condo? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Christine Whelan is a professor of consumer science in UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Christine, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
Good morning. We also have Finaba Otto, who is an associate professor of public policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Finaba, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me this morning.
Well, let's start with you, Finaba. Prior to the pandemic, many young adults were already struggling, already having lower incomes, higher cost of living. It seems like light years ago, but there was the Great Recession that they also had to deal with. What kind of financial obstacles are younger generations facing?
Yeah, so you've centered in on one of the key defining events of the millennial generation. So we had the Great Recession. A lot of them were exiting college or just finished college when the Great Recession hit. And then now we have, you know, the current pandemic and the economic recession. So we see, you know, with the Great Recession, a lot of them came out of school ready to enter the job market. But we also know there was rising student loan debt among a lot of these students and their families. So a debt has been an ongoing conversation among millennials and its consequences for the ability to acquire those conventional metrics of adulthood, such as obtaining a house or starting to save for retirement and even wanting to start a family. So we already had those delays happening, and now we get hit with the current pandemic and recession. So that's what we're
seeing. Finaba, why is student loan debt, why does it continue to be rising?
Oh, so there are lots of explanations as to why contributions to the rising aggregate student loan debt. And just to kind of cite a figure, as of, you know, last year, it's surpassed $1.7 trillion in aggregate. So we're talking really large numbers. So there's a large number of households that have had to take on debt to go to college or to pursue post-secondary education. And there's been this shift from the financing of higher education onto students and their families. So there not only are there more students going and pursuing higher education, but the amount and the cost that they have to incur in order to do so is growing. And a lot of people, a lot of households just don't have the financial support or financial security to pay directly. So they turn to credit markets in order to make this investment in themselves and their families.
Christine, you run the Money Relationship and Equality Initiative at UW-Madison. What do you see in terms of student loan debt and how you balance that out with the other debt that is accumulated for a younger generation?
Well, the first thing we see is that this is something that should be a topic of conversation, but it's so scary and all-consuming for a lot of people that it kind of gets pushed under the rug. And so we see more and more couples who are trying not to talk about it. And then when they do talk about it, you know, we have to figure out, when you're talking about money, what really are you talking about? You're talking about the ability to do what matters to you. So when it comes to relationships, you're talking about, you know, the ability to form relationships, to be able to support your partner if your partner chooses to take a lower paying job. You're talking about your ability to start a family. And all of these conversations are something that are incredibly important to have, because when you don't have conversations about money, then you end up with lots of fights about money. And research tells us that fights about money are those fights that tend to last the longest and be the most destructive to relationships.
So this debt is permeating everything in life, all of these really big decisions, whether it be relationships, whether it be kids, whether it be, you know, buying a house.
Yeah, I mean, you can think of it as an albatross that you are stuck with potentially forever, certainly would feel like that. And so taking on the big financial responsibilities of perhaps even more debt to buying a house, or having children. My grandmother always used to say, well, don't worry, every baby comes with its own loaf of bread. And the idea, and I thought, gosh, that's such a cute expression, but so not true. So you know, you put off these things until you're financially able to do so, and that has real economic and social consequences even far beyond the couple.
We're talking with Christine Whelan, who is a professor of consumer science in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Finaba Otto is an associate professor of public policy at UNC Chapel Hill. We're discussing how millennials approach money and the disparities in wealth generation with you. You can join in. Are you struggling to find your footing financially in life? What seems the most important to you at the moment? How do you balance your short-term financial needs with your long-term goals? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Finaba, how do the trends that you see compare to with millennials, compare to what the older generation, what even their parents experienced at their age?
Yeah, so a lot of the research that has been coming out, and including some of my own, is just showing consistent delays in transition. So one of the hard parts about doing research is you have to wait for, or especially doing research on recent cohorts of young adults, is that you have to kind of wait for them to age and for the transition to happen. So what we actually want to point to is the delays. So they're not achieving, like I said, those conventional markers such as buying a home ownership in one's late, you know, 20s to early 30s. A lot of them are returning to school when the job market, the labor market goes downturns. And so we see, you know, not being able to find work and then having to return to school, or finding, you know, establish a career and establish that financial security at the same points in the life course or the same ages as previous generations, as their parents. And one of the things I also want to highlight is that impedes the ability to start savings, right? So what we're really starting to see in the data is lower wealth, right? Lower wealth accumulation and lower wealth holdings. And as we spoke about in the last segment, the contribution of debt to that trend.
Well, and that return to school in and of itself is a risk, right? Because it's more money toward tuition. You're taking a risk as to whether this new degree or reconfiguration of your career will pay off. And meanwhile, you're not working, perhaps, or only working, you know, at a lesser amount. So that is a risk.
Absolutely. So what we see is what we see is not only, you know, the debt accumulation. What we see is not only the debt accumulation from undergrad, but also grad school. And there's actually some growing research that is showing that the graduate school debt is the debt that is weighing down a lot of people. When you see those media stories about over $100,000 worth of debt, those six-figure debts, that's a large chunk of that is graduate school debt.
Christine, would you like to jump in here?
Yeah, that's a great point. All right, Don, I'll place you on hold and we'll get you on.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're having some technical difficulties. Christine, go ahead.
Yeah, no worries. So the interesting thing about the school decision is that school also has been really a sort of sold to us as in our culture, the more education has been sold to us as more opportunity. And so we have a cultural narrative that if you're struggling, you know, get another degree and this will open up doors for you. And to some degree, that is true. And so, you know, we also have a very interesting, I think, sort of mixed message going on in our society. What is the quote-unquote best and smartest thing to do? We used to have this idea that student debt is quote-unquote good debt, and that we shouldn't worry about that as much. That narrative may be changing. So, you know, it is for young adults, we want to do the right thing, right? You know, you want to follow the right path. And yet that right path is murkier and kind of hazier than ever.
Christine Whelan directs the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative at UW-Madison. Finaba Otto researches debt and the racial wealth gap at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. What is your financial situation? How does it compare to before the pandemic struck? What did a parent or grandparent teach you about money that informs how you handle your finances now? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute, more conversation about money on the Ideas Network. We're discussing millennials and this generation's financial prospects here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On the issue of student loan debt, President Biden, on his first day in office, told the Education Department to extend the pause on student loan payments and collections and keep the interest rate at 0% through September 30th. What does this mean for you? Will it give you some breathing room? Millennials, what do you face that is starkly different than your parents' generation in terms of finances and mobility? 800-642-1234. Finaba Otto is an associate professor of public policy at UNC Chapel Hill, focusing on wealth inequality. Christine Whelan is a consumer science professor at UW-Madison, and they're with us for the hour. Let's bring in John now, joining us from Richland Center. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. I have a comment and a question for you, Professor. My comment is that I'm a parent of a millennial. My son makes $150,000 a year, but I was taught differently as far as income, expenses, entertainment, and investments. I think they spend too much on entertainment.
They have different values toward money. I'm going to, Christine, I want you to field this first.
Yeah, so this really is, this is an interesting one. So when we think about our values around money, we have to think about what is important to us, not important to, unfortunately, to from our parents' perspective and to our parents or to others, but what matters most to us, and then spend our limited resources, not just of money, but of time, in keeping with those values. And so entertainment may be a core value right now. The others might say, well, it might be a value now, but what about the future? And why aren't you saving for a more stable future? The challenge for some of these young adults is that they have seen their parents and work really hard and have so much of their retirement taken away from them in various financial crashes. So, you know, spending money now and enjoying your life when you can is not really an irrational choice in uncertain economic times. But certainly spending in keeping with your values is one of the things that I really encourage people to think about.
Finaba, when you look at a salary like that, but cost of living, you know, you do have to, I would assume, see big differences between generations.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that I first want to highlight is not only the differences in the generations, but also the returns in the labor market to to pursuing higher education, which is tied into that student debt. So as Christine touched upon, we think, you know, pursuing higher education and even taking on debt is not an irrational choice. It actually makes sense when you look at the lifetime earnings that many young adults who have attained a college degree will receive over the course of their lifetime. However, that return is much higher risk for millennial generation as compared to their parents and previous generations. One of those risks is financial, and the other risk is associated with the economic downturns and the ability and the frictions in the labor market that we see happening. So, I applaud the previous speakers, excuse me, callers, son's ability to find work and find a well-paying job, but there's also a lot of risk for a lot of young people out here who have the college degree and are trying to find stable employment and a well-paying position.
And just trying to make the right choices at the right time in order not to be hamstrung or compromised or, perhaps even fall out of the middle class. That can be really stressful, Finaba.
Absolutely. So that's one of the things that comes up a lot in the research that we do is how fragile the young adults in the in our samples and our data find themselves who are even have made it to the middle class. Yes, they have the income, they have the job, but they may not have necessarily enough savings that can hold them over in the event that they lose those jobs, that they experience a health shock or, you know, something that temporary to their household that will help them weather those periods of, uncertainty.
We're talking with Finneba Otto, who is an associate professor of public policy at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Christine Whelan here as well heads the Money Relationship and Equality More initiative at UW-Madison. We're looking at wealth in our country and what millennials are facing in particular. With your questions, your stories, in what ways have you been able to be more frugal, or do you find that your financial situation is quite fragile? 800-642-1234 to join in. Chris is with us from Madison. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm here. I'm a millennial. I wanted to give some food for thought for the older generation out there, my parents and grandparents' generation. When my dad was young, he was able to work at a grocery store and pay his way through college doing that. And the reality is that an expectation to have a normal job and pay your way through college is no longer what the world looks like. There's been sort of a 40-year process of this kind of neoliberal defunding of education, thinking of it less like a public good and more like a private enterprise with families and students as, you know, the paying recipients of that. And I think it's maybe important to understand that for me as a millennial, part of it too is this whole family conversation of like, hey, the world is changing, and to a certain degree, people have done this on purpose. This is the natural result of sort of political choices that we've made.
Finneba, could you step in there? What do you see that of this shift that Chris is bringing up?
Yes, Chris is raising a lot of the points that we know what has happened in higher education, and as I spoke about earlier, this shift in costs from the government paying for most of the cost of education or subsidizing education and shifting it on to students and their families. So we see a lot of rollback in state appropriations to higher education over time in particular. And that has meant that the cost that students and families have had to incur has risen. And so like the example that Chris gave of his grandfather being able to pay his way through college, well, college was significantly, well, the share of the cost that his grandfather had to pay for college was significantly lower than what we are seeing that students and their families are having to take on today. So he's absolutely right that there have been changes in policies, a lot reflected in the cost, the shift in cost that have made going to college, as I said, more riskier for millennials and for generations after them.
Yeah, Christine, once upon a time, you could work hard in the summer, save up all those earnings from waiting tables or from working at a grocery store, as Chris brought up, and then pay your tuition bill the next year.
Right, and you really can't do that anymore. Yet our cultural narrative about what success looks like and what you're quote-unquote should be able to do hasn't kept up with these changing times. And I think that's what Chris is really talking about, which is He and many other millennials probably have that internalized sense that they've done something wrong. And when really what we're looking at is a cultural shift, yet our discussions around money tend to blame the individual when what we're seeing is a very much more difficult financial circumstances for this generation, for everybody. And so thinking about whatever your financial problems are, not just as your own individual choices, but as part of a larger whole is important, not because it may necessarily change what you are doing on a daily basis, but I feel like we really need to move away from blaming everybody, and saying, oh, well, it's their individual problem, rather than something that we need to address as a society.
Finneba, some people are really getting hit here with loss of income during the pandemic. What are you seeing in the numbers?
Yes. there are specific pockets, especially, you know, people who prior to the pandemic were already struggling. So, yes, we were coming off of an economic recovery from the Great Recession, but there were some people who had not recovered as well. In particular, Black communities and Black families and households who were maybe just starting to accumulate some savings and then were were on the frontline workers and essential workers and had to either lose their jobs or had to work in very risky situations. And so and then we have that competing with also with the school closures and childcare. So there's so many factors that have led to the financial insecurities and instability of the last year. And we're seeing this drop. Oh, sorry. We see this showing up in the data with the most vulnerable households, most economically vulnerable households, and those tend to be largely Black and Latinx households
Fenneba Otto and Christine Whelan, Research Debt and Wealth Inequality. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. Millennials are the generation with the fastest growing debt. We're discussing what this means and the growing racial wealth gap here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For whom is higher education a driver of upward economic ability? Black young adults take on more student loan debt than their white counterparts. How do we measure mobility when our nation has extreme wealth inequality? Join in 800-642-1234. Fenneba Otto studies these questions as an associate professor of public policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Christine Whelan with us is a consumer science professor at UW-Madison, where she directs the MORE Initiative, which stands for Money, Relationships, and Equality. They're with us for the hour. Let's bring in Jim now in River Falls. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thanks for having the program. Your last caller brought up a little bit of what I wanted to talk about, but we've seen now that universities don't receive the funding from public, you know, from governmental agencies anymore that they used to. They've been forced to privatize, which affects the agenda of what gets taught to some extent too, and they've needed to increase tuition so much to help fund them. Right now, and also, I mean, my wife is adjunct faculty, and you see cuts to faculty members too. They hire a lot of adjunct faculty because they don't have to pay them as much. They have more disposable faculty, so it's not helping the faculty either. There's about $7 trillion in student debt right now, and I see now there are some groups talking about, you know, student loan strikes. I mean, because this is something that really has burdened society with overwhelming debt and being unable to get out of this. So,
Jim, thank you. I want Christine to jump in here. And by the way, you know, the UW has had a tuition freeze for years now.
Yeah, so this gets into some really complicated politics. And for my research in the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative, we try to take a step back from that and really try to help individuals and couples ask the questions and have the conversations about what choices are right for them, and then what it means for them and their relationships. I mean, you know, this is something that I've always been very interested in. What is the different? Where is that balance between the individual responsibility and the social change responsibility? And certainly in this, there's a lot of social change to be done. On an individual basis, though, we do have the opportunity to talk about what money means to us, what this education means to us, and what success looks like to us. And rather than necessarily buying into old ideas of the past, we do have the opportunity to create new methods of achieving success and new definitions of success. So I think the millennial generation is really going to be the ones that are going to lead the way on that.
Finneba, you study the racial wealth gap. How are Black borrowers in comparison to managing student loans in comparison to their peers?
Hi. Yes. So what we see is that Black student borrowers have higher loan balances on average, and they have higher default problems or higher default rates when they are in repayment. So they are struggling both in the accumulation of debt. So they have a lot, they require lots more debt, and they take longer to pay it off. These trends are largely tied to what you know, large racial disparities in wealth, the inability of their parents to assist them in help paying for college or help them, you know, providing transfers to help pay off their debts a little bit quicker. So we really see that Black borrowers, and this is what's most striking in a lot of these the work that has come up about this, is that this is independent of whether or not they receive the degree or not. So we see these trends happening for those who have no degree, as well as for those who have completed their college degree.
So what does that mean for our society, for wealth creation, for transferring wealth to the next generation?
Yeah, what that means is that the racial wealth gap will continue to persist, and is the work that we've seen, especially related to student loan debt, it may be being perpetuated amongst the recent generation. So not only do we not see a closing of the wealth gap, but maybe even it could be growing over time due to this new additional factor of student loan debt that's contributing to the inability of Black borrowers to, to acquire more assets, or for their parents to transfer wealth onto them, because their parents, which is coming up in a lot of our research, also have debts of their own from when they attended college.
And they are closer to retirement age, which also can be very scary if they don't have that savings.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Finneba, when you look at rising tuition, is that just one layer of the issue here? Because, you know, people often point to tuition. Well, tuition's going up. That is the reason for this disparity. But it sounds like it's much more complicated.
Oh, yes. It's much more complicated. And there's actually some evidence that shows that among public institutions, that the rise in tuition has maybe a little bit overblown, or is not as much as some people, you know, like to say that it is. It's really this idea of the shift in the cost to families and the ability of families to take on debt, both subsidized and unsubsidized, to help assist paying for college. And so that gets into, you know, when we think about household finances and why are so many families within our society don't have the savings, they don't have the wealth to draw upon in order to support their children or themselves if they want to pursue higher education. So, you know, it really comes back, I think, you know, the work that both Christine and myself do is looking at the family and family household decisions. And that could be tied to labor market decisions, the housing market. You know, there's just so many different factors that are contributing to these financial instability issues that we see are being carried on. Yeah.
It's a web. It's all interconnected. We are talking
Absolutely.
With Finneba Otto, who's an associate professor of public policy at UNC Chapel Hill. Christine Whelan here. She's at UW-Madison, a professor heading the Money Relationship and Equality Initiative. We're discussing the financial picture for millennials, what pressures they face, what it means for their future. Are you still paying off student loans? How long have you been paying them? When will you be done paying them off? And what does your future hold? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Eric now, joining us from Nina. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Yes. I am a millennial, I guess. I went to school for nursing. I did not graduate. I had taken out substantial loans for, you know, being able to afford it, and those were on a 30-year timeline. And since I haven't graduated for the last, it's been 10 years now, I have been working many different jobs, and I've even returned to healthcare and have been working healthcare all through this
pandemic.
Palabra. Yeah, sure.
Eric, what is the interest rate on your student loans?
You know, I try not to look at it because I'm paying a mortgage on it, and I am trying to focus on the future. And so in doing so, seeking to get even more education has proven a bit difficult because lenders tend to not want to extend any credit, given that the jobs that I have been working are hardly, you know, enough to pay off even what I have taken out. And on top of that, I mean, I've had to withdraw again this semester, or for my classes this semester, because I mean, I've exhausted it all, and it seems as though I bought a, you know, I really put myself in this position. And
well, I
want to. Millennials have.
Yeah, Eric, thank you for bringing your story. Christine, what advice can you offer Eric?
Oh, this is such a hard situation, right? Because, you know, life happens, and sometimes you do have to withdraw from university and from education. This is and then yet these things compound each other. So I would really sort of take it one step at a time. There are some sort of basic financial planning and budgeting exercises that can really help in terms of the day to day. And then in terms of the long-term career planning, there are some jobs that you can go into that might offer some loan forgiveness. And it's worth doing some research about that. But really what I think what he's speaking to is this larger sense of sort of it all seems so impossible. And that feeling, I think, has permeated so many folks, especially during this pandemic, that just surviving is enough right now. And it feels so difficult that planning for the future is something that that we can't even get our heads around. This is not good for the future and financial and family and job stability of this generation, but it is certainly the real feeling right now.
You know, Finneba, Eric feels extremely stuck as he laid out his situation. Is there anything else you can say?
Yeah, I will say that, you know, he's not alone. that you know, the growing number of millennials and, subsequent generations who have come after them, who have had to start and stop their educations, who are had to take on a significant amount of debt to do so, is growing. I like to show when I'm teaching my students and when I'm giving talks, this chart that shows that, you know, for the bulk of millennial and their generation, some have just touched or have enrolled at some point in their lives in higher education. So the majority of them have had this interaction with higher education. Mm. A lot of them are sitting in that some college, but no degree category. So he is not alone. And his story, I'm sure a lot of people are out there nodding their heads or listening, and it's resonating with them. And I think that's why this conversation around student debt has become a national one.
Finneba Otto researches debt and the racial inequality gap at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Christine Whelan is here. She is a consumer science professor at UW-Madison. Are you struggling to find purpose and meaning in life due to your financial constraints? How do you balance your short-term financial needs with your long-term goals and what you want to do in life? Do you regret a career decision because you don't think it will allow you to live the life you desire? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about intergenerational wealth inequality and what it means for the millennial generation, especially people of color. The share of millennials earning more than their parents has reached its lowest point on record. Only half of millennials are earning more than their parents did. That's according to researchers at Harvard. We have Christine Whelan, a consumer science professor at UW-Madison's School of Human Ecology, and Finaba Otto, who is an associate professor of public policy at UNC Chapel Hill. They're with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Jim in Madison now with observations. Jim, hi. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. I'm listening to the show, and I'd like to bring this into the discussion. You know, talking about the student loan debt and how that burdens that millennial generation and generations moving up through that right now. Shouldn't we also throw into this discussion maybe that a lot of kids maybe don't need a college education? I'll reference the trades. I know I work in the trades. I'm in my mid-40s. I've worked in the construction trades my entire career. Zero college debt, a healthy six-figure salary. I can tell you that I manage a fairly decent-sized construction company. I could put a high school graduate to work today, pay him $65,000 his first year, and within 4 or 5 years, get them close to a six-figure salary with absolutely zero student loan debt. Wouldn't that kind of help if there was more promotion of that?
Well, Jim, thank you for that. And I want to bring in Christine. Jim, bringing up the trades and going through the process of the journeyman process, you know, and that you don't necessarily need a college degree.
Absolutely. I am so glad, Jim, that you called in and that you mentioned this, because this is incredibly important. And by the way, we are in, as certainly in Madison and nationwide, we are in need of more people in the trades. And so more people going through this this apprenticeship process and learning by not attending college, learning by doing. So this is it's a great point, and certainly something that that we should consider more. This is something that we also need to kind of see a cultural shift around, because we still have the idea that if you don't go to college, then it is lesser in some way. And yet I can tell you that, yes, as Jim said, there are people in the trades, most people in the trades, who are making more money than so many of the recent college graduates that I know that are struggling with college debt. So yes, absolutely. This is a really, really important point. And I'm just so glad that you mentioned it. I hope many people are listening and considering this for themselves.
Finaba, you know, some manufacturing companies, some assembly line work, they have difficulty getting the workers. They train them up and then, you know, sometimes they leave.
Yes. So I echo what Christina said. Christine said that this is an important conversation that we need to be having. I know there's a lot of discussion within higher education and in higher ed circles talking about how do we reimagine higher education so that there's choice, right? And that we think of all the different alternatives as equally beneficial. And there's sort of like, we think of it like a matching, you know, what skills and what skills can you bring and to be matched with the job, career, profession that's best suited to you. For some, it's going to mean that you need to pursue that college degree, but for others, it may not require that kind of that pursuing that particular path. So if we, you know, start to shift our conversations to kind of thinking about how do we reimagine what comes after high school, I think that this will allow us not only to discuss some of the points that Jim brought up, but also think about, well, what is it? Why is it that there are parts of the labor market where there's not enough supply of labor, right? Why is it that certain employers can't find enough individuals to hire or that are applying for those jobs? And I think it's a conversation that we need to have. Absolutely.
Jay sent us an email from Madison. Jay wants to know, what are some of the promising solutions, Finaba, to closing the wealth gap?
Thank you, Jay. Thanks for that question. Promising? I think, you know, one of the things that I is first is to establish how large the wealth gap is. So, you know, the median Black households has about the tenth the median wealth of a white household. So we're talking, you know, significant disparities in wealth. Whereas I would like to believe that, you know, eliminating the student debt disparity will get us there. It's just not enough, right? We need to think more comprehensively about how do we increase the resources that Black households have. So there's a lot of talk going out there. There's actually, it's not necessarily a race-based policy, but a socioeconomic-based policy, this idea of baby bonds or opportunity accounts that would entrust children who are from the lower ends of the income or wealth distribution with a sort of trust that they get at birth and that would, you know, would gain a little bit with inflation or over time, so that by the time they were of age, they could use that towards either pursuing their education or starting a business or, you know, just so that they have some asset to work from. That a lot of households who do come from the higher ends of the wealth distribution are offer their children. So somewhere, so there's been some proposals, and there's been actually a lot of interest in that particular policy solution. I will say that we do need policy-based solutions in order to really address these huge wealth gaps within our society, though.
Let's bring in John in Green Bay. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing? Great conversation. Wanted to bring up, I didn't graduate college, but I went to college in 2006. It was a private college. They had me sign loans. They packaged me up, and they don't tell anybody this. I'm thinking it's grants or money I don't have to pay back. They package you up. I'm a 17-year-old, way down south by myself. My parents aren't there. They're telling you, sign this, sign this, sign this, and then you sign, and you go, $20,000, and nobody explains to you this stuff in high school. That's one of the problems. The other problems is like the trade industry. I work in the trades now, and I wish I would have known that 15 years ago so I didn't have no student debt, because you do make a lot more money, and they need to get more people from the inner communities to go out and do these things like truck driving or construction trades or anything like that.
John,
and then the third, the racial disparity thing, it's true. You start off behind the eight ball. My mom, my mother, my grandparents, I don't have anybody to give me a house or a car or start off with good credit or 15 years old, you got a nicer car than I got at 27. Like, it's crazy. People don't want to admit it, but somehow we need to be able to start at a level playing field. And that the only way that will happen is cash in people's hands.
All right, John, and we're short on time here. I want Feniba to respond. And Feniba, you know, John is echoing what your research has found.
Yes, he is. He's speaking to the data. And I think he raises lots of points, but we've discussed today everything from going to college as a young adult, taking on a lot of debt to do so, not completing that degree, but also finding a match within alternative options such as the trade field, and how that has been quite fruitful for him, like the other caller spoke about. But then also kind of understanding how the intergenerational wealth cap can manifest in individuals' lives. So he's touched on a lot of different topics that we've touched on today.
Absolutely. Well, Feniba and Christine, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having me.
Christine Whelan is a professor of consumer science at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Feniba Otto, an associate professor of public policy at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.